In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
You know what's shocking? That here in 2016, there is a significant amount of people alive today who have no real grasp that just 30 years ago, we were engaged in a Cold War with the USSR. And seemingly, the only societal remembrance we have of that time is a few James Bond movies. In fact, a lot of people today don't even know that the USSR was a country. It wasn't that long ago that the Soviet Union collapsed, imploded really, because it followed the path of socialism, while the U.S. followed the path of capitalism. This November 2016, it will be just a mere 27 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall in November of 1989, which really marked the end of the Cold War. Just 27 years later, and a socialist is running for the U.S. presidency. A socialist! Imagine for a moment a Nazi running for president in 1972, a mere 27 years after World War II ended. That's the situation that we're in. So on today's show, it's all about socialism. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Dr. Richard Rahn of the Cato Institute to talk about and expand on socialism. But in these first couple of segments, I'm going to be walking you through what socialism is, the danger it represents, and really lay the foundation for the rest of the show. Now, to get back to the idea that we're just 27 years past the fall of the Soviet Union, the evil empire, some of you who are a little older and a little wiser may be saying, oh, wait a second, the Soviets were communist, not socialist. But here's what the socialists don't tell you. Socialism and communism are both forms of socialism because they are forms of the government where the government controls private property. Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged, said, there is no difference between communism and socialism except in the means of achieving the same ultimate end. Communism proposes to enslave men by force, socialism by vote. It is merely the difference between murder and suicide. There's another quote, equally good, though I don't recall who said it, is that a communist is an impatient socialist. If you really want to make a socialist head explode, tell them Nazis were socialist. Because even though Nazism and fascism did allow some private property, it was still the government that decided who could own what and controlled how much you make. But we'll save that for another show. But yes, Nazism, socialism, communism, fascism, they're all under that same socialist umbrella, the umbrella of big government and big government control. But what is socialism? Our guest in his article, Socialism Equals Coercion, defines socialism as, quote, socialism is a system in which the government owns or controls the means of production and allocates resources and rewards. The encyclopedia puts it this way. Socialism is a doctrine that calls for public rather than private ownership or control of property and natural resources. According to the socialist view, individuals do not live or work in isolation, but live in cooperation with one another. Furthermore, everything that people produce is in some sense a social product, and everyone who contributes to the production of a good is entitled to some share in it. Society as a whole, therefore, should own or at least control property for the benefit of all its members. Yeah, you can certainly hear elements of Bernie Sanders there, and Hillary as well. I think a simple way, though, to think of socialism is that in a socialist society, the government has more control over you than you do. In a free society, you have control. Socialism is about power and control, make no mistake about it. It is the control of the masses by the control of the few. Socialism is when you give your freedom to the government and allow the government to determine how successful you'll be allowed to be. At its core, the debate between socialism and capitalism comes down to one thing, property rights. By property rights, it's more than a house or land and includes everything you own. Your house, your car, your land if you're a farmer, your business, even the money in your savings account. There are a lot of things that bother me about socialism. Socialism thrives on ignorance and inability. Socialism excels where there is ignorance. It is a system pushed on people under the guise of helping them when it really means taking away their rights. I like Winston Churchill's quote on this. Socialism is the philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy. Its inherent virtue is the equal sharing of misery. What bothers me about socialism is that it's an immoral system. The only way socialism succeeds is when it distorts truth, distorts reality, distorts history, distorts basic human behavior. It sometimes boggles my mind that a political economic theory like socialism that can never work in the real world continues to be promoted by so-called intellectuals. In fact, even Einstein was one of them. Probably because they think they know better than you, something I'll discuss in the next segment. Socialism claims to be a moral and fair system, but what is moral about taking from someone else? It assumes they got their wealth by stealing from others, and society is somehow justified by taking it from them. When it gets right down to it, socialism is an evil system. Reagan was absolutely right when he called the Soviet Union the evil empire. At the heart of socialism is jealousy and envy. Can't make it in life? Not as successful as someone else? Then take it from them. All while claiming you're doing it to help someone else. If you want to help someone else, then you do it. Otherwise, it's like you're taking from your neighbor's refrigerator to feed the homeless. How is theft moral? People who have never lived through socialism seem to be the only ones who want it. Anyone who has lived through socialism never wants it ever again. Okay, time for a break. Coming up in the next segment, we'll take a look at the history and the origins of socialism, and then coming up, we'll take a look at why free markets are just so much more superior. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Every week we help you keep an eye on big government. And today we're talking about big government in the form of socialism. You know, in the last segment I gave you a breakdown of what socialism is, the control of private property and the wealth created from it. The technical definition is, in case you missed it, socialism is a system in which the government owns or controls the means of production and allocates resources and rewards from those means of production. That's as defined by Dr. Richard Rahn, who will be joining us in the bottom half of the show. Right now, I'm laying the foundation for that discussion in both this segment and in the next. You know, for socialism to work, you really need to forget about two things: human nature and history. So let's start with a little. The long history of socialism, because in some sense, the argument over who should own what and be able to make a living off of what you owned has been with us pretty much since the dawn of time. In early societies, might made right. Kings and pharaohs owned the land. You had the ruling class and then, of course, the subjects. As mankind progressed and trade increased, the merchants increased in power because of the value of the goods they could acquire from far-flung lands. Kings, read that as government, got out of the way. Merchants ended up growing in wealth, and it began to not matter so much whose family you were born into. You could end up earning your way in life and making something of yourself. You didn't have to be born into the ruling class. Ironically, what really started socialism was the Industrial Revolution. As factories sprang up with new technologies that lowered the cost, steam power, and all the rest, goods could be made more cheaply and sold to more people than ever before. People end up leaving farms in droves because they could make more money in the factories than they could ever dream of making on a poor dirt farm that the king had allowed you to live on and pay rent to him. Along with this came a new class of merchants, the business owner and management. Even Karl Marx, of the Communist Manifesto fame, even Karl Marx marveled at the wealth created by the Industrial Revolution. As part of this and preceding the Industrial Revolution, there were new theories in economics and international trade, such as Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, one of the real foundation stones that helped build America. It's hard to really overstate the importance of Smith's work. There was this quote that I find especially interesting. "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard of their own self-interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love. We never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantage." In other words, this is a recognition that people will and do pursue their own self-interest. This was revolutionary at the time. In his work, Smith emphasized the pursuit of one's own economic interest, which could actually enhance public welfare and society as a whole. Another important aspect in here is the rise in the belief of property rights, the right of the individual to own property. And of course, that was very foundational to the Great American Experiment, where we embrace the rights of the individual, of each individual, to pursue life, liberty, and to make our own way in the world. As I said, Karl Marx recognized the incredible achievements and wealth created when just a few generations ago there were widespread poverty. Socialists in here didn't want to disrupt the economic material miracle, but merely to redistribute the profits and to make it more fair. Socialism, as I said, traces its roots as a response to the Industrial Revolution. But interestingly, socialism is not just an economic, but a moral and religious response as well to the American experience and, in a large part, to Christianity. The wealthy families of Europe in particular began to rise up in response to the American experience. But they weren't fighting for the working class or fighting to right the wrongs of inequality, but instead they were reacting to the Republican representational democracy and individual liberty that was happening in America at the time. The last thing these European elite wanted was to endorse some representational democracy or the Christian faith that supported it. What's interesting to hear is some of the philosophical roots for socialism, especially in the works of Immanuel Kant in the late 1700s and early 1800s. Kant taught metaphysics and spiritualism, where morality does not come from God, but rather from the state, where only those trained to reason correctly can dictate what is or is not moral. One of his disciples expanded on that. He said, "Cooperation with the state is the only true freedom." So in other words, the state decides what is moral. And remember, this is the same society, these were both German writers, this is the same society which inevitably gave rise to Adolf Hitler. The state decides what is moral. As far as the term socialism itself, that started, like so many other bad ideas, in France in the 1820s in a movement called the Saint-Simonians. And the name they used for their movement was socialism in opposition to what they called individualism. Some 30 years later, in February of 1848, the French dethroned the Orleans king and gave every male in France the right to vote. They ended up electing a parliament where 90% or more unconditionally supported private ownership of the means of production. This was a smashing defeat for the rise of socialism. The socialists were forced to realize that only a small minority of the nation actually approved of their plans. The socialist elites there saw themselves as the vanguard of the so-called unwashed masses, the backward and uneducated. They know better than the rest of us what will be the best interests of the nation. They have the sacred duty, they saw themselves, they have the sacred duty of overthrowing the majority and establishing their own dictatorial power. Democracy, they saw, was a mere thin disguise for the rule of the so-called exploiters. But these socialists were not prepared to yield to the verdict of all of these unwashed masses. Hoping to seize power by violence, this small group of socialists rose up in arms in what was known as the Paris Revolt of June of 1848, a mere few months after the election. A small minority of armed men tried to defy the vast majority and establish a reign of terror and tyranny, and of course they were defeated. Why is this important? Because it has haunted free society ever since, especially in Europe, the specter of terrorist dictatorship by a fanatical minority. Doesn't that sound a lot like today? All right, we need to take a break, but coming up, we're going to be talking about free markets and why they are so superior to socialism. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about socialism, and in the next segment, we'll be bringing in Dr. Richard Ron of the Cato Institute to talk more about that. We've been laying the groundwork, though, for that discussion, and you know, really the problems with socialism is that it can perhaps work in small communities of people of like mind, like skills, and like beliefs. You know, the famous communes, for example, or even Christianity, where they had monastic life. These were small, enclosed enclaves. The problem, though, is when you try to force that way of thinking, those beliefs, on a large group of people. And force becomes the operative word. Socialism, of course, has killed tens of millions of people through the two centuries of experiments with it. So let's compare and contrast. In the socialist system, government controls property and the means of production. The principles of free market economics, however, include individual freedom, private property, limited government, and free trade. For free markets to work, consumers must, by definition, have free choice among various options, and buying decisions must be voluntary. Healthy markets have common characteristics. There is the principle of supply and demand. Consumers have a choice among sellers, which are all in competition with one another, trying to gain customers on the basis of price and quality. And on the other side, there is a consumer trying to get the best deal for his dollar. If you understand nothing else from today, know this. The free market is the best possible means to determine the most accurate price for goods or service. This is because the acceptable price arises naturally from within the market rather than being imposed on it from without by a government bureaucrat. In the 1940s, Friedrich Hayek took the position that prices reflect the perceptions of large numbers of individuals within a market. He said this, quote, "Economic calculation cannot be reduced to a set of equations, because the knowledge underlying such calculations is the sum of countless perceptions of individuals in the market." End quote. This is one of the advantages of a natural free market over centrally planned markets, such as socialism, where prices are at the whim and speculation of a few bureaucrats, rather than the thousands or even millions of individuals all making individual buying decisions. Think of it this way. You know, when I was a kid, I used to love Super Balls, and I would get two of them especially and bounce them back and forth in the hallway, watching them hit against the walls or even against each other and bounce in new directions. Now, I guess if you're a government bureaucrat, you could probably study that and come up with some kind of calculation to determine which way those balls are going to interact. Well, that's two balls. Imagine, however, if you had a gigantic dryer, a gigantic clothes dryer, where you had not just two balls bouncing back and forth, but millions of those. Those are the decisions in a marketplace that some bureaucrat is going to have to try to understand in order to determine the best price for a good. And without an understanding of price or even an inaccurate price, you don't have an understanding of value. Socialism inevitably fails because you have bureaucrats trying to decide what the value of a good or service is for somebody else. Finally, the cornerstone of a free market is that you must have the freedom to choose whether or not to participate at all. This is why Obamacare will fail. Why? Because your threat, your decision not to buy, is the single greatest motivator companies have to cut prices. Your decision not to buy helps to drive price. This is why free markets succeed. When buyers are free to exchange money for goods or services from sellers, each side believes that they are better off after the exchange. A consumer buys a loaf of bread for a dollar, and they're in a better position to feed their family. That has value to the buyer. The seller, on the other hand, sold an item for a dollar that cost them 30 cents to make, giving them an ability to pay workers and produce more bread for more customers. That puts them in a better position. Under a capitalist free market system, the business person seeks to produce goods and services that a consumer wants, they value, at the lowest possible cost, which includes having the smallest and most productive workforce possible in order to maximize their profits as a businessman. It's about value. A business seeks to create value by creating products or offering services that people want to buy. Compare that to socialism. Under the socialist model, the political leaders decide what people should have, which is very often different from what they want or need, and there is no genuine concern for value. There's no genuine concern for efficiency because there's no concern about profits. You're all just cogs in a wheel. In capitalism, you have to convince other free people to willingly part with their money. You do that by creating something so worthwhile that they will happily give you their hard-earned money. This is a key point because in a free market capitalist society, you must create value to succeed and to grow. In a socialist society, there's no concern about value or productivity or driving down costs. And here's the rub. While you can compel people in your own country to buy something, you can't force your goods on the people of another country. America's lurch towards socialism did not suddenly start with Bernie Sanders. The foundation for the Bernie Sanders movement was laid brick by brick with every regulation and spending program that favored one industry over another, favored one company over another. If you want to know why the threat of socialism exists today, it is the direct outcome of big government policies of Obama, of George Bush, Bill Clinton, and every president before them that sought to expand government at the expense of freedom. The entire reason America has succeeded in its past is because throughout our history, there has been the American dream to come here and to have a shot at making it big. People left monarchies to come here. It was the lure of liberty and the opportunity to come and be more successful than you could ever possibly be by staying in another country that allowed no such upward mobility. No one came here because they wanted to have 90% of their life's labor taken from them by the government. All right, everyone stay with us. We'll be talking a little bit more about socialism with Dr. Richard Rawl of the Cato Institute. Stay with us. And welcome back. On today's iSpy radio show, we're talking all about socialism. I'd like to bring in now Dr. Richard Rawl. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and chairman of the Institute for Global Economic Growth. He also writes a syndicated weekly economic column, which is published in the Washington Times, Newsmax, and many other places. Dr. Rawl, it's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, I mentioned that you write some articles. In fact, you've got a great one up there right now, just published a week or so ago in the Washington Times, and it's called Socialism Means Coercion, and it's a fantastic article if people just want to kind of get an overview of what exactly socialism is. But in that article, you mentioned that much of the world's population greatly suffered under various forms of socialism in the 20th century. Not one of the various socialist models proved to be a success. So why do you suppose that a political system for which there is some, 100, 150 years and several dozen experiments as countries have tried and failed socialism, why do you think people still continue to think that this time it might work?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because actually we go back a couple hundred years with socialist experiments in the modern era, and there was things going back to antiquity, and they always failed. And it's like people never learn from history. Part of it is just the ignorance of history. Mm. I'm amazed young people in the United States, most of them do not have a clue of what socialism really is, what it leads to. And in the United States, we had lots of socialist experiments with, you know, sort of private socialist experiments like the Oneida community and other utopian communities were set up. They always failed. And of course, there people were free to leave. There wasn't coercion. There was coercion inside the community, but you know, the people could opt out, unlike the various socialist governments around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it's been tried, it has always failed. It always leads to economic stagnation or worse. It results in a total loss of liberty over time. And in reality, all countries have a little bit of socialism, as we do in this country with, you know, government owns the passenger railroad, Amtrak, and some other things. We don't have a whole lot of that. In other countries, they have a lot more. In Britain, after World War II, when the socialists took over, they bought the steel mills and the rails and a number of other of the what they call the commanding heights of industry. And of course, they ran them all into the ground, and it was a disaster for Britain. And finally, Britain elected Margaret Thatcher in 1979, and she then turned around and privatized most of what they had socialized, and the economy boomed. So we had these endless examples, and I had spent a lot of time in the old Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. I had chaired the Bulgarian transition team and worked on transition, but I'd been there beforehand. And I saw just how totally gruesome it was, how it just stripped away any kind of human dignity, ambition, and of course, it left virtually everybody poor. And yet, young people, again, don't know about this, and part of it is because they get such a lousy education, particularly in the public schools. They're not taught history, particularly world history, and really what happened.
Yeah, isn't that kind of a twist of irony there, that schools have essentially been socialized because they're all run by the government, and therein lies the perfect example of the lack of efficiency and good quality when a socialist program is instituted. The schools are failing, and yet they expect socialism to work.
Yeah, I mean, you look at your Department of Motor Vehicles or the Veterans Administration. These are examples of socialism, and it's really quite amazing that, you know, with Bernie Sanders out there talking about government failures, but then he wants government to be take over the entire healthcare system, free colleges, and all this kind of thing. And we've seen the result of what happens when you do that, and it's always a disaster.
Yeah.
Because you take away socialism is not only coercive, but it takes away all the incentives.
Yes, and that I think right there is the key point, is that you really do remove the incentive for people to go out there and try to start a business. I think a prime example of that is actually what's happening here in Oregon. The last couple of years have been just brutal in terms of new state policies that are out there being enforced on new businesses. So if I'm out there and I'd like to start a business, I've got all of these different hoops I've got to jump through. I've got they're now looking at raising the minimum wage, and so I'm going to have to raise extra capital. You got all of these different hoops just in terms of hiring, which you can and can't ask anybody in during the interview process. So I've got all these hoops to jump through if I can even get the business going. And in a socialist society, I would have to ask permission to even launch the business in the first place. Compare that to a free market society. Here is my money. I've got an idea. Go.
Yep. I mean, it just is, more regulation, more taxes, and as government starts to operate things, they always end up running in huge deficits. You know, they start off saying, oh, no, we're going to manage it well. But, of course, they never do. And then the deficits cause taxes to go higher. I mean, we look at all the tax increases Bernie Sanders has already proposed.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's underestimating the cost of his projects. And so you get these prohibitive tax rates. For instance, Sweden had tried, they didn't really, wasn't so much government ownership of things, but they went to an overwhelming welfare state. And by the 1980s, the economy had pretty well grown to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
It was Sweden was once one of the richest countries, and by the 1990 or so, had fallen to 17th place, or had been up around 4. And then the Swedes sort of woke up and they said, well, these tax rates we have, getting up around 100% or so, are killing us. So they went into a reversal. Now, Sweden still has a government way too big for my taste, but they have what they've done is gone to a voucher system for schools. They've done the Chilean privatization of Social Security, the Chilean system, which has been adopted by 30 countries. And so they've actually done a lot of a rollback of the welfare state and socialism. Again, in Britain, we saw a big rollback of the government ownership of these enterprises. And, of course, the British national healthcare system ended up being sort of a disaster, but then the British allowed private health care in parallel, which gave the national system some competition, which, of course, then improved that, and then people do have the alternative.
Yeah, and it's always funny how when people like Bernie Sanders want to point to the so-called success of socialism, they're inevitably pointing to a formerly heavily socialized country in terms of the actual removal of some of the socialist policies. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Lots more with Dr. Richard Rahn talking about socialism. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking a little bit more in depth about the European socialist experiments. Welcome back to the iStar Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Richard Rahn. He's a senior fellow with the Cato Institute and the chairman of the Institute for Global Economic Growth. The Cato Institute, in case you don't know, is a think tank, quote, dedicated to the principles of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Dr. Richard Rahn also has a syndicated weekly column, which can be found on the Washington Times, Newsmax, and other places, and we'll be sure to link up to some of those articles on our website, iSpyRadio.com. Just look for today's show, which is 6-06. And so we were talking about some of the experiments there in of socialism over there in Europe, and generally when a Sanders points to the so-called success of socialism, what he fails to point out is that it's because they've suddenly started to privatize and move away from socialism, and all of a sudden that so-called socialized country is starting to click along again, oddly enough, when they have gotten rid of socialism. But I'd like to back up to a little bit to something you said in the last segment. You mentioned how people fail to remember history, and I think that that's a really great point. You had mentioned, too, the aspects of how Britain started to nationalize some of its steel industry and so on after World War II. Talk to us a little bit about what that was like in terms of nationalizing, say, things like the steel mills and so on. Did they just go in and confiscate the ownership of those steel mills? And what did the owners get out of that?
No, in Britain, they actually they paid for these various enterprises. I'm not sure the owners got full value, but they at least paid for them. It wasn't the kind of confiscation that you had in places like Cuba or in Russia or China or places like that, where the productive assets were just basically stolen, seized from the owners. And in our country, when we've had government take over things like passenger railroads with Amtrak, they actually paid for the things. A couple of them were in bankruptcy when they took them over, but the others, they paid for them. That's one reason, the difference between a democracy, which does still protect private property and the rule of law. But again, socialism over time undermines the rule of law.
Right.
Because, there's always the bias towards government in any kind of dispute between parties. And if you're fighting the government, you're always given a bit of a losing hand. The government has infinite resource and infinite number of lawyers, even if you're in the right. It's like people have trouble, fighting the IRS and a lot of government agencies. So if you really want liberty, you're better off with small government for many reasons, economic efficiency among them. And, of course, being an American, I pride liberty. Our founding fathers set the country up, and my own ancestors fought for it. So it's a very important value in itself, and that's often overlooked by the socialists when Bernie Sanders or the others say, "Oh no, we're going to run this. We're going to do this." Well, they're taking away the rights of individuals to control their own destinies.
Yes. Yes. Well, and getting back to the confiscation there of the railways and whatnot there in Britain, why did they do that?
I want to be clear. Britain did not confiscate. It purchased.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Russia, China, Eastern Europe, and Cuba and places like that confiscated. There's
right.
a big difference.
Right.
Confiscating, you just grab it.
Right. But in terms of nationalizing it is maybe a better way to put it.
Yeah. Nationalization is the correct term.
Right. So why did they do that? Why did they think that nationalizing that was somehow going to lead to, what, more efficiencies, lower prices? What were they thinking?
Well, I think they thought, well, they had, it's this class warfare stuff. I mean, the British socialists talked about it in the way the American and everybody else, all these socialists talk, how the rich have all these things.
Right.
And if we just take from the rich and redistribute it more equally, the prices will be lower and everything will be better. Well, of course, everything always turns out to be worse because you've taken all the way of good incentives for good management, for good work. And also a thing that's overlooked is innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And back when I remember when I was working in Eastern Europe and doing the transition, I would have some of these socialist and communist economists come to me, and they would have their little charts of showing how many labor inputs and capital inputs and how many units that they were going to get, tables or chairs or whatever. And I'd say, well, where's the room for innovation? And they look at me sort of blankly. In socialist economies don't innovate. Steve Jobs, he couldn't operate there because there'd be nothing in the five-year plan for an iPad or an iPhone because nobody had thought of it. It wouldn't be in the plan. And that's why another reason these economies are all stagnant and why they always have to steal the technology from the capitalist economies.
Yeah. Speaking of stealing, we have a relative that lives in a socialized European country over in Sweden, actually. And what she has said is that essentially the government takes 70% of what they earn. But they say that, it's no big deal because the government pays for everything, so everything that they would need, so they don't really mind it. Is that what you see in a lot of these socialist countries, that they are willing to trade their economic freedom for a little bit of security?
Well, you do find that in Scandinavia. But their incomes, per capita incomes in Sweden are about 30% lower than they are in the U.S. Sweden is poorer than it would be if it was more capitalist. You know, Norway likes to talk about how it provides all these social benefits. And Bernie Sanders talks about Norway being this great example because they're rich. Well, they got rich because they have huge quantities of offshore oil, and they're basically a petrostate. But the problem in a place like Sweden is that the high tax rates, and now their maximum tax rates, a little over 50%, still an awful lot. And that does diminish incentives, and people don't, because of that, don't work as long and as hard. And they have, a lot of social welfare benefits. But again, all that stuff tends to be somewhat substandard, even in a place like Sweden and Finland and so forth, which tend to be small, homogeneous economies, which are more adaptable to socialism. It's sort of like a club or a church group, but larger economies, and when you have more diverse people, it doesn't work at all.
No.
But again, these are social welfare states as opposed to socialism. They got rid of most of the government ownership of enterprises,
right?
Because most every place they realize that's a disaster. In fact, what I found is even the most diehard communists don't want to go back to having government-owned restaurants. The restaurants in the Soviet Union just used to be awful. You go in there and stuff was unedible with no choice.
Yeah, wow. Just imagine your restaurant being run by the IRS. All right, everybody, stay with us. We're going to have lots more with Dr. Richard Rahn, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, coming up. We're going to be talking about some of the myths of socialism. Welcome back. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Rahn. He is a senior fellow of the Cato Institute, and we've been discussing socialism. And so I'd like to talk about some of the myths of socialism here. One of the big ones, of course, is that the rich don't pay their fair share. It's obviously not quite true because they're paying. There was a CBO study that found not only are they paying their fair share, but they're actually paying the fair share of a lot of other people as well. But there is this myth, though, that they don't pay enough, and also that you do see corporations being able to dodge taxes and whatnot. For example, GE didn't pay anything in, I think, fiscal year 2010. Google is another one that is able to hide a lot of wealth offshore and so on. So what's the answer there in terms of paying fair share? Would a flat tax actually be the answer?
Well, a flat tax is good for individuals. Actually, you ought not to have a corporate tax. People are under this strange misconception that if you tax corporations, somehow you're getting by in sort of a free lunch. But corporations are nothing more than a form of doing business. And if you have a tax on corporations, what it means is the workers are going to have lower wages, the consumers are going to have higher prices. These costs, cost of taxation is passed on like any other cost of operation for a business. You know, taxes and regulations are costly. Again, it means higher prices and lower wages. And it's very inefficient to tax them because you don't know really where the incidence of the tax is falling. And, of course, all jurisdictions have many different corporate tax rates. And so people complain, well, corporations move to places where there's low taxes. And I say, duh. If you're a business manager, you're running a company, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your stockholders to operate in the lowest tax environment, other things being equal. So, of course, you know, the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the world now. So it's no mystery why corporations are leaving the U.S. and moving to other places. Like Ireland, we charge 35% corporate tax rate. The Irish have a 12.5% corporate tax rate.
Right.
If you're a business person, what are you going to do? The sensible thing is for us to reduce our corporate tax to at least the Irish level, or actually get rid of the whole thing because, you're equally as well off. It means if you got rid of the corporate taxes, wages would be higher and prices would be lower.
Right.
I think that's a win-win.
Yeah.
And you'd have higher productivity, you know, more growth. It's enormous advantages. And I listen to all this stuff, and it's just nonsense. Like, people can't think beyond stage one.
No, they sure can't. Speaking of not being able to think of beyond stage one, one of the big complaints by the Bernie Sanders supports and Democrats in large part as well is this notion of wealth inequality. And so in a free market, capitalist societies, to play devil's advocate here, doesn't wealth ultimately end up in the hands of the few? And are there, or even should there be, any remedies for that?
Well, it's very hard. I mean, this has been a complaint all through human history.
Yes.
Because there's always been a relatively small group at the top of any society. And it was true among the communists. When I was there, you have the nomenklatura would have all these special stores and all these special benefits. And the benefits were still not much in wages, but they were, you got, if you were part of the favored class, you got the big apartments, you got the big cars. And maybe that show up in your paycheck, but you had all the benefits, and you got all the Western goods. But people think of the corporate executives, of them getting, some of them the big salaries. But they don't think about things like entertainers. I mean, what happens if you had a football team where all the players on every team got the same amount of money? What do you think would happen? People love bands and singers. Now, if we said anybody who sings has to get the same wage regardless of talent, what do you think would happen? People don't seem to have any problem paying, fairly high ticket prices for a band or some group they really want to hear. And even though they could go down to the local church and hear somebody singing for free. If people would think more about that, and that people who are the best in any particular field, whether it's sports or the theater arts or movies or entrepreneurs, managers or whatever, if you're particularly skilled, we pay you a whole lot more, and the reason we pay you more is because you give more value added than the cost. If a singer, for instance, tried to charge too much, people wouldn't pay to hear them. And so you have it's voluntary wealth redistribution. I mean, somebody like Lady Gaga is far wealthier than virtually all of her fans. But her fans go in there and pay to hear her and buy her products, so they have a voluntary wealth distribution from poorer people to a very rich young woman.
Yes. Yeah, and I think it's that fundamental lack of understanding when it comes to value and value creation, and also the whole pricing of it. I mean, like you say, is that... I'm looking at my clock here, and we are up against it. Dr. Ron, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We look forward to having you back sometime to talk a little bit more in depth on some of these other issues.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me to your show.
All right, thank you. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's show. Let us know what you think, and whether you walked away a little wiser about socialism than when we started. There was a snafu this week with Ted Cruz, and regardless of what you think of Ted Cruz, and to be clear, I do like Ted Cruz, it's an example of why big government never works. You can be the most ethical person in the world, but at some point, you will stumble, or someone you appointed will stumble. Adding more people to government means that you are exponentially increasing the likelihood of cheating, lying, stealing, power building, or what have you. A system of government has to take into account human nature, not at its best, but at its weakest. And that's why government must be as small as possible and have as little control over you as possible. Be sure to check this week's show page for tons of links on socialism, lots more to see up there. But as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.